The name of my talk, not surprisingly, A Velocity History of the United States, 1929 through 2012. The motivation for writing the paper that I did behind this was it actually grew out of the talk that I gave last year at AERC, which I'm sure everybody remembers because everybody saw it, was on the quantity theory of money and some revisions or reformulations, for lack of a better word, that I'd made to it. The other motivation that I had for writing this was that it's nice to break up monetary history into periods that you can study or compare with other periods. But heretofore, I don't think there is a very good way to do this, or at least in my eyes, it hasn't been satisfactorily done. The common way, I suppose, that monetary history gets broken up is by looking at different periods of recessions. Recessions typically hinging on some kind of decline in output or decline in income or something of this nature, more of the mainstream definition of a recession. The reason I don't really like doing this, besides all the other reasons, I suppose, is that it masks more than it reveals that declines in output can be overcome, let's say, by borrowing money, by leveraging the economy and papering over some of the losses. And to the extent that the Austrian business cycle, that Austrian business cycle theory is the framework that you're using to describe a boom-bust cycle, a decline in final output or income is not a very good measure that you could be using to measure a recession. So I wanted to use a little bit of a different approach, and in doing so, I wanted to talk about what a recession is during an Austrian business cycle. Now, if the boom is a structure of production which is being misaligned with what real underlying preferences suggest should be happening, the bust is realigning the structure. And in the normal exposition, that would mean that your structure of production is being lengthened artificially during the boom and that it needs to be shortened or shrunk up in some way during the cleansing recession that follows. And I was trying to think of a nice way that we could actually express this, because at least in my eye, there isn't, to me, there isn't out there right now a nice, easy, simple measure that we can look at to say, here is the economy or here is the structure of production shortening up. And the proxy that I used, or the measure that I am going to use, is by looking at the velocity of the velocity of money, for reasons that will become clear as we go over the next 15 minutes here. Now, the only problem with using the velocity of money as the measure to proxy a recession, or rather to proxy a shortening in the structure of production, is that the common measure that we have to look at the velocity of money is ill-suited for the task. And by ill-suited to the task, I mean that it's a bit of an ad hoc theory. It's a hodgepodge of concepts that are thrown together without too much thought into what the actual concepts are. So to give you some examples of what I'm really talking about, most equations of exchange, which people are deriving the velocity of money from, use some ad hoc definition of money, right? Whether we're going to use M1 or M2, or more to the point, the definitions of money are actually imposed after the fact to align with what people think is happening to either nominal output, or to equate growth in nominal output to growth in a money supply or something of this nature. And very few people have actually, when using the equation of exchange, given real thought as to what money's central role is and then how we can define it according to that, instead of just constructing the equation of exchange and then trying to define your money after the fact. Another reason that I don't like it is that most equations of exchange differ on what they're actually going to include in terms of monetary transactions, whether we're looking at final output. Last year in my talk, if for those of you who remember, I said, well, it's not just final output, which is important, but it's also this whole concept of gross domestic expenditure, all of the intermediary expenditures that are taking place. And in particular, I want to add to this, as I did last year, the whole idea that we should be including debt repayment and equity investment in the sum of monetary transactions that are taking place if we want to include them in the equation of exchange. And really, there's two good reasons why we should do this. The first is that typically debt gets excluded from the equation of exchange because it just represents a wealth redistribution. One person is lending and they lose purchasing power, and another person is borrowing and gaining purchasing power. But this is not true for all types of debt. So, for example, a lot of bank-created credit or fiduciary media does not represent a loss of purchasing power for somebody. As long as it's predicated on a fractional reserve, there is no corresponding loss in purchasing power. Or external debt or money flowing in on current account also doesn't represent or doesn't have to have a loss of purchasing power within your domestic economy, because the foregone consumption is being foregone in some foreign economy. So we can exclude these just for the pure reason that they represent the means of payment which don't correspond to a lack of expenditure by somebody else in the domestic economy. Debt repayment and equity investment as well, I would add to this, are also uses of money, which if you undertake them, limit the expenditures that you can make on all other goods and services. So we should almost be including broadly all of these monetary uses of money, including debt and equity investments that you could be undertaking. Now, for those of you who read, I'll assume everybody did read it. What I'm going to show you now is based on my article in the Journal of Prices and Markets called The Quantity Theory of Money. This is where I formally reformulated the existing quantity theory of money and made the necessary changes to it. And in particular, I break it down into two sides. One side of the equation is the expenditure side. And expenditures, monetary expenditures that you can make are basically threefold. On the one hand, you have the purchases of real goods and services. We could count this as GDP, I suppose, if you want, for lack of a better way to express it. And then also your investment side of purchases, which can either be paying off your debt or deleveraging yourself or the aggregate economy, or investments that you're making in equities. And on the payment side of the equation, there's basically three means that can serve as the final means of payment for any monetary expenditure that you make. Those are money circulating at some velocity, settling your expenditures, new fiduciary media created by the banking system, and then finally external loans coming in on current account all represent the means of payment which don't have to the final means of payment in the economy. Final, at least in any given time period, because of course any external loan coming in on current account is going to be repaid at some time. Sometime in the future. Now, I just want to go through this quickly, not because it's important, but because we can understand what's going on with velocity from it. So on the left-hand side of this equation, we have gross monetary expenditures, PQ, you can use as some kind of expenditure being made or some level of expenditure being made on goods and physical goods and services. Delta E is net inflows into equity investments. So if this is positive, it means that there is a positive inflow of money into the stock market. If it's negative, people are selling off equities, removing money from the stock market. And delta L is the variable that I use for the flow of debt into the economy. If this is negative, it means that the aggregate economy is deleveraging or people are paying off their debts. If this is positive, it means that people are leveraging and taking on more debt. So then on the left-hand side of the equation, the total sum of monetary exchanges that you can do are in the goods market, PQ, in the equity investment market, positive investments in equities, and if we have an increase in L, that is saying that people are going into further debt. If it's a negative, it would mean that people are paying off their debt, which is why we would want two negatives there to add it into the total sum of monetary exchanges. And then on the right-hand side, we have the three means that we can use to pay for these monetary exchanges. I use the true money supply here, which Joe developed in his article back in the 80s, I suppose now, mid-80s, back before I was born. MR is the reservation demand for money services. So the true money supply is the total amount of money which is available to enact transactions. And MR is that sum which is held to satisfy people's reservation demand for money. I take this to mean money which is not being used in its medium of exchange role, something that people are actually holding on to as a stock. It's circulating at some appropriate velocity, V. Money coming in on current account is going to facilitate the final payment of goods and services in any time period. Of course, if money is flowing in on current account, it's negative. if money is flowing out on current account or if you're making loans to foreigners, that would be positive. And delta B is the change in fiduciary media or bank-created credit over any given time period. So if this is positive, it means that banks are in the net issuing more fiduciary media than there was previously, and that's serving as the final means of final means of payment for the goods and services and investments on the left-hand side. And we can just rearrange this to solve for velocity. And from this, we can draw some conclusions about what velocity is and why it's actually relevant to us. Velocity is one way that we can talk about the demand for money as a medium of exchange. When velocity is increasing, it means that people are demanding to use money more frequently or more times in any given time period to satisfy all the goods and services that they want to buy. This is really the flip side, and this comes from your simple model of money prices, simple theory of money prices, simple model of money prices that Joe has. An article in the QJ from the late 90s, velocity is really just the flip side for the demand for goods and services, right? People demand to buy goods and services, and thus we need to have money acting as a medium of exchange to settle those expenditures. An increasing V is really saying that people are demanding to use money more frequently to buy goods and services. But the interesting thing in velocity here comes from the way that all the other variables interact with it. So just to go quickly through it here, velocity is going to be increasing if the demand to buy goods and services, PQ, is increasing. That's pretty straightforward, and that's the way that it's commonly understood, I think, for us anyway. But then look at the way that all the other debt or investments interact to change velocity. For a given level of goods and services being purchased, so if PQ is constant, velocity is going to increase if the total amount of debt in the economy is decreasing. That means if the economy in the aggregate is deleveraging, if people are paying off their debt, money has to work harder in order to buy the same amount of goods and services defined by PQ. If delta E is increasing, it means that money is in the aggregate flowing into the stock market. And if that's increasing, velocity increases as well. Money is going to have to work harder, or a given amount of money is going to have to work harder or circulate more often in order to purchase a given amount of goods. Money coming in on current account. So if this is positive, it means that you're lending money to foreigners. That means that money that exists in your economy is going to have to circulate more rapidly to buy a given amount of goods and services. Velocity increases. And delta B, if banks in the aggregate are deleveraging themselves or withdrawing fiduciary media from the market, it means that the resultant sum of money that remains is going to have to work harder, or velocity will increase to buy the same amount of goods and services. And if you look in the denominator, so anything that is going to decrease the denominator increases the velocity of money. So that can be either shrinking your money supply, anything that reduces the true money supply, or if people suddenly demand to hold more money to satisfy their reservation demands, MR increasing would also have the effect of increasing the velocity of money. Now, a velocity of money is actually a way, I said earlier, it's a way that we can use to proxy lengthening or shortening in the structure of production. And here's why I make this statement. Velocity tells you how many times each monetary unit was used in an economy in a given year. This is different than the total amount of expenditure on final goods and services, or GDP, in any given year. If velocity is increasing, it must mean that more transactions are taking place along the structure of production and not counted in the final figure of GDP than if velocity is decreasing. And a decrease in velocity must mean that your structure of production is shrinking, or that there's fewer monetary transactions taking place along the structure relative to the amount of final output or GDP. Here's a little graph of what it looks like over time. The first thing that you'll see, I compare it. My measure of velocity for the true money supply is the blue line, and then I just want to compare it up there to the velocity of money, the typical velocity that gets given for M2, M2 being the closest mainstream definition of money to the true money supply. More or less, they align. My definition of velocity is quite a bit more volatile. But the part that I want to point out now, and then we'll go over it in more detail, is that you can see some real trends going on in velocity of money. The early 30s to 1942, velocity of money is sharply dropping off. Actually, 1942 is a very strange year. The velocity of money is pretty close to zero. And actually, that's because the total amount of new debt that was issued in the American economy in that year was almost the exact same as the total amount of total income earned in that economy that year. So almost every expenditure on final goods and services was debt-based in America in 1942, leaving not much role for money to actually satisfy or to settle monetary exchanges. And then starting in 42 and going through until the early 60s, 60, 61 right here, we see a steadily increasing velocity of money. This I take to mean a lengthening of the structure of production, although we'll look at that. We'll give more evidence for that in a moment here. Starting in the early 60s, right clear through to the 70s, of course, this probably is consistent with what you would think of as being a recession. But actually continuing right through to 1986, there's a broad-based fall in the velocity of money. Picks up again until the late 90s, 1997, 98 up here. Then we get another fall off to the mid-2000s, 2007. And then a quick spike up here at the very end until 2010. So we have some definite periods of ebbs and flows in the velocity of money. Now, the velocity is how I actually proxy lengthening or shortening the structure of production and by association how I'm going to define recessions. But there's maybe a better way that we can use. Mainstream people want to use, or mainstream economists want to use, changes in income as the definition of a recession. And there's a lot of good Austrian work that says, no, income is not what we should be focusing on, but gross domestic expenditure is what we should be focusing on. So here's a look at gross domestic expenditure over time. The red line is actual GDE, as reported by total tax receipts in America over this period. The period being 1959 through 2008. And in blue, I've actually imputed gross domestic expenditure from our velocity statistic. And here's how you can do it. Our velocity statistic tells you how many times each unit of money is used in an economy in a given year. The total amount of money units that each person earns in a given year is their income. And we can use GDP fairly well to proxy for net income in any given year. Net income times velocity will give you the total sum of expenditures which are enacted with earned income. And then we can add into that all of those expenditures that are debt-based to arrive at some level of total gross domestic expenditure in any given year. And actually, the imputed GDE that I have matches the actual reported value through tax receipts fairly closely, with some minor divergences that happened here in the late 2000s and a little bit of underreporting for this span from the very late 70s to the mid-1990s. Gross domestic expenditure, when it's increasing, it means that there is a larger amount of expenditures taking place in the economy, of course, but you can also take this to mean that the structure of production is lengthening. Now, if you were to look at this, you'd say, well, the structure of production must be lengthening continually. This might be true. It is true. Although the rate of change goes through different periods. So here, if you were just to take the slope of my blue imputed GDE line as the growth rate of gross domestic expenditure in the economy, you can see some periods where it's increasing very quickly. My angle is not your angle, so it's hard for me to see what's a rapid increase, but this from the pits of the Great Depression up until the early 1960s is a fairly quick growth rate relative to this one throughout to the mid-1980s, which picks up again, which flattens off again, which picks up again. I'm going to compare these later on to the actual phases of recessions that we can record by dating changes in the velocity of money, just to give you a better picture of it. The final thing that I want to show you that you can, the final little fact that you can take away from my velocity measure of money is that we can get an indication of how much expenditure is taking place in the economy in any given year because of the issuance of new fiduciary media. We know how much new fiduciary media each bank or banks in the aggregate are issuing every single year. And we can multiply that out by the velocity of money to get the total amount of transactions that that new fiduciary media is settling. And we can normalize it by stating it as a percentage of some appropriate variable. I use gross domestic expenditure. So this blue line here is just tracking what percentage of total expenditures in an economy in any given year are actually because of new fiduciary media issued by the banking system in that year. And again, we see some periods where a lot of the expenditures are based on issuances of fiduciary media, like this one from the early 60s to the mid 80s, or this one here throughout the late Great Depression until World War II. And we see some periods where not many of the transactions taking place in the economy are predicated on issuances of fiduciary media, like this period right here throughout the 50s till the early 60s, and then throughout the late 80s, early 90s, into the dot-com bust of 2000. Now, the reason why I show these three graphs is because I want to give you some stylized facts of recessions from an Austrian point of view. We use this word recession all the time, and yet we oftentimes don't have a good measure that we can give to show people what a recession in an Austrian business cycle actually looks like. We know it's realigning the structure of production, but what does that actually mean? Here's a couple of stylized facts for you. The red and green bars are just the breakdown of different periods of either expanding velocity of money. Those are the green bars, which I take to be boom periods, or the or declines in the velocity of money, which I denote with the red bars there. I've broken these periods down and stated what the average velocity of money is in each of those periods. And as you can see, and as you probably would predict ahead of time, recessionary periods like the 30s, the 70s, or following the dot-com bust have much lower average velocities of money than boom time periods do. The average gross domestic expenditure growth rate over those periods differs as well. In recessionary periods, as you could predict, and this is based on my imputed GDE figure, by the way, the growth rate of GDE is quite slow relative to what it is during boom time periods, denoted in the red. And then, perhaps counterintuitively or not, depending on your point of view, this final column shows the average amount of total expenditures in an economy which are based upon fresh issuances of fiduciary media by the banking system. And here we actually get the result that in recessionary periods, as defined by declines in velocity of money, a greater portion of the total amount of expenditure taking place in the economy is due to new fiduciary media. 12% of all expenditures between the period of 1931 through 41 were because of new credit issued by the banking system. There is one outlier to this, which I want to just mention briefly, and that's the period of 2008 to 2010, where it seems like a fairly or a relatively high percentage of total expenditure is taken place by, or is paid for by, new issuances of fiduciary media. And primarily this high figure is the result of two facts. Both have to do with deleveraging in the American economy over this period. The fact that the current account, which was starkly negative going into 2007, all of a sudden started to turn around and shrink, or it was still negative but moving closer to positive territory over these 3 years. And also the fact that the private economy was deleveraging over this period as well, meaning that debt was taking less of a role in paying for final goods and services, and fiduciary media and true money were taking on a larger role. The point of this all, again, I just want to reiterate, is to give Austrians a way that we can discuss recessions in some meaningful way without making, in meaningful ways which are more consistent with maybe how mainstream people are talking about recessions. And I don't mean this as a point to give in to them or anything like this, but to come up with actual measures that we can use to provide some stylized facts for what an Austrian recession actually looks like, instead of relying on the verbal description of the structure of production is shortening to align itself with the preferences of savers and consumers. Thank you.